Good morning, everyone. I think about a month ago, I gave two sermons from Daniel. I was trying to focus on faith and how when we have faith, God delivers us. I get really encouraged by the courage and faith Daniel and his friends show in the book of Daniel, and even more so encouraged by how God honors that and delivers them. Somebody came to me after I gave those sermons, and they asked a good question. What does that practically look like for us? I mean, the books, the stories of Daniel give really good general ideas. Don't compromise, have courage, and have faith. But it doesn't really give a lot of very specific things in that we can do. It gives some, like, I guess, don't close your window when you're praying, if that's what you normally do. But otherwise, it's helpful to also get into more specifics. Okay, what does that look like practically? And Nehemiah is one of my favorite Bible people. He's not a prophet. He is not a priest. He ends up becoming governor, but he's not a king in the line of David. He's just an ordinary guy with a zeal for God and prays a lot. Also, the time period, this is during the time of Artaxerxes, first Artaxerxes in the late 5th century B.C. This is a couple decades after the captivity that has ended. And unlike the time period of the first century and the time period of Moses, we don't see a lot of miracles happening by the hands of men. So in a lot of ways, this is very comparable to the time period we're in. And so you want to look at some good practical examples of how to have faith and have courage in times of difficulty, it's really hard to find a better example than Nehemiah. If you're unfamiliar with the book of Nehemiah, Nehemiah is a cupbearer for Artaxerxes. His brother comes to him and tells him the trouble that Jerusalem is having. At this point, the temple has been rebuilt, but they've stopped using the temple because the walls aren't rebuilt. So when Nehemiah hears about this, his heart is broken in chapter 1. And then in chapter 2, when the king notices how sad Nehemiah is, he asks him, well, what has have you upset? So Nehemiah tells him what goes on, and the king grants him permission to rebuild the walls of Jerusalem. And then in chapter 3, we get an introduction to all the different people, men and women of different occupations and ages working on the walls. But as it often happens, when Satan sees God's people doing good, he's not content to just sit there and let it happen. So God's enemies, the enemies of the Jews, get stirred up. And so in Nehemiah 4, Nehemiah and his companions face opposition of different escalating degrees. And it's a really good example of how to react when we face those same kinds of opposition when we're doing work in God's kingdom. So please read with me Nehemiah chapter 4, verses 1 through 6. Now when Sanballat heard that we were building the wall, he was angry and greatly enraged, and he jeered at the Jews. And he said in the presence of his brothers and the enemy and the army of Samaria, "What are these feeble Jews doing? Will they restore it for themselves? Will they sacrifice? Will they finish it up in a day? Will they revive the stones out of the heaps of rubbish and the burned ones as that?" Tobiah the Ammonite was beside him, and he said, "Yes, what they are building, if a fox goes up on it, he will break down their stone wall. Hear, O God, for we are despised. Turn back their taunt on their own heads, and give them up to be plundered in a land where they are captive. Do not cover their guilt, and let not their sin be blotted out from your sight, for they have provoked you to anger in the presence of the builders." I got something else I should have mentioned about Nehemiah. Nehemiah writes the book of Nehemiah almost as if it's a journal, and we really see that here. And so they're rebuilding the wall, and Sanballat and Tobiah, which are wonderful names for villains, you know? Like, if you can't ask for better names for villains here. When they hear what's happening, the opposition starts off mostly verbal. They attack them. They mock the Jews for their efforts. And the sarcasm couldn't be more clear. Obviously, the Jews aren't going to build it in a day. What they're saying there is they're mocking the effort they're putting in. They know they can't build it a day, but they're mocking them for the effort. They're mocking them because they want to sacrifice offerings to God. They're mocking them because they don't believe that they're able to take such ruins and bring them back. I mean, keep in mind, Jerusalem was just ravaged by the Babylonians. There's a reason why it hasn't been rebuilt yet. The destruction was incredible. So in the eyes of God's enemies, God's people looked like fools, and they made clear how they felt. Something else that is interesting about this, in verse 2, Sanballat is saying this in front of the army of Samaria. Samaria was the northern kingdom. Now, they've got mixed in with other peoples because of Assyria, so now they're more pagan than Jew. But these should have been people who you would think should have been on the side of rebuilding the temple. At least some of them should have been. But now they're acting as enemies of the Lord. And worse yet, it's not like these are people far away. Samaria is just due north. So these are real threats, real insults and real jeers from their next door neighbors. And if we want to get practical, what to do when things like that happen, we see what Nehemiah does. He immediately goes into prayer. In fact, the way he's writing this in his journal, he goes immediately from what they say to his response to God. It's almost kind of hard to notice right away. It almost sounds like Tobias saying it until you read a little bit more. Whenever we come into hard, difficult times, this is the first thing we always should do. Now, sometimes we don't remember to, but as much as possible, this is what we need to do first. And there's a lot of reasons why. The first reason why is the reason we see Nehemiah doing. He puts the burden of vengeance and justice in the hands of God. See, oftentimes when we're insulted and offended, it can be really distracting. We see in verse 6, after they pray, we built the wall, and the wall was joined together to half its height, for the people had a mind to work. Nehemiah and his companions were able to have a mind to work because they cleared their minds of whatever trauma and pain Sanballat would have afflicted. They put that in the hands of God. They didn't need to worry about that. If you want there to be something to consume your mind very quickly, focus on vengeance, taking vengeance for yourself. That will consume your mind and your focus really, really, really fast. When we go to God in prayer, we absolve ourselves of that. In 2 Peter chapter 2, verse 9, Peter writes that the Lord knows how to rescue the godly from trials and to keep the unrighteous under punishment until the day of judgment. I don't know if Nehemiah knew that, but Nehemiah believed that. Nehemiah prayed to God that very prayer. God, you punish them. And that's saying, I'm not going to do it. That allows Nehemiah to focus on the work. Second is prayer is how we ask God for help. In Matthew chapter 6, Jesus gives us his model prayer. And there's a lot of things he tells us to pray. One thing he tells us to pray is to protect us from temptation. God tells us we need to obey, we need to live righteously. And God also says, ask me for help and how to do that. Now, it's not our job in the kingdom to build walls. That's not our mission in God's kingdom. In fact, we kind of need to tear down walls when you think about it and bring people in. But for the work they were doing, Nehemiah prays a lot throughout the book, asking for God's help. And, you know, sometimes I think because we live in the age where spiritual gifts no longer happen like they did in the first century or the time period of Moses, we can think, well, God's not really going to intervene or ever help me in my life. But you know what the crazy thing is about this time period? In Esther, Ezra, and Nehemiah, I've never seen a prophet performing miracles in that time period. Yet, when you read about that time period, you see God's hand at work the whole time. God is constantly answering prayers and protecting them. And for us, it's clear, but I don't think they would have seen it, at least immediately at their time, but it was still happening. That applies to us. God is so powerful and wise, he can make miracles happen and nobody knows it. Think about the birth of Jesus. That is the most powerful miracle, maybe like his crucifixion, that ever happened. But people only had a clue about what happened because God sent angels to tell the shepherds. Otherwise, nobody would have been the wiser. God can do incredible things that people don't understand are incredible. So don't underestimate the power of prayer. Also, prayer helps us to stay focused on the work. In Matthew chapter 6, verse 10, Jesus tells us to pray that God's will be done. When we go through difficult times, one of the best things we can do to keep ourselves to persevere is by remembering what the goal is. Insults, disparaging comments, those things just distract. But by being steadfast in prayer, Nehemiah, his companions, and us can stay focused on the goal. Verse 7. But when Sanballat and Tobiah and the Arabs and the Ammonites and the Ashdodites heard that the repairing of the walls of Jerusalem was going forward and that the breaches were beginning to be closed, they were very angry. And they all plotted together to come and fight against Jerusalem and cause confusion in it. And we prayed to our God and set a guard as protection against them day and night. In Judea it was said, the strength of those who bear the burdens is failing. There is too much rubble. By ourselves, we will not be able to rebuild the wall. And our enemy said, they will not know or see till we come along them and kill them and stop the work. At that time, the Jews who lived near came from all directions and said to us 10 times, you must return to us. So in the lowest parts of the spaces behind the wall, in the open places, I stationed the people by their clans, with their swords and their spears and their bows. And I looked and arose and said to the nobles and to the officials and to the rest of the people, do not be afraid of them. Remember the Lord, who is great and awesome, and fight for your brothers, your sons, your daughters, your wives, and your homes. So after the jeers and the insults don't work and the God's people continue working, do Sanballat and Tobiah just sit back and say, okay, I guess that didn't work? No, they escalate. They go from just saying mean words to plotting to go fight against Jerusalem. That's quite the escalation. It's gone from risking emotional pain to real physical pain, death. In verse 9, Nehemiah does two things. First, like Nehemiah always does, he prays. That's Nehemiah's superpower. Superpower we can all have. He prays. But he doesn't just pray. He doesn't just pray and say, okay, we prayed, it's all good. We can just pretend like this isn't an issue. He doesn't say that. He sets up a guard as protection against this raid, both day and night. Now, from what we see later, like what we read in 10 through 14, and then what we will read, it seems like this precaution is the lightest of them all, because as we're going to see, as the threats escalate, so do the precautions. But notice what he doesn't do. At the first threat of violence, he doesn't shut down the work. At the first threat of violence, he doesn't say, all right, we're getting out of here. At the first threat of violence, it's interesting, we don't even see him trying to negotiate with God's enemies, which I think is interesting. He sets a guard, he sets an appropriate precaution, and then they continue working. Well, oftentimes, when Satan sees God's people doing good, he's not content to just let it happen. It continues to escalate more. In verse 10, now they're attacked not from without, but from within. In Judah, it was said, the strength of those who bear the burdens are failing. And then again, in verse 12, you have their Jewish neighbors who aren't partaking in the work coming to them and saying to them 10 times, verse 12, you must return to us. So keep in mind, Satan can use a number of tactics to attack us. Sanballat and Tobiah aren't the only people trying to stop the work. Now, sure, their Jewish brethren probably have better intentions than Sanballat and Tobiah. Don't get me wrong. But they're certainly not helping. That's for sure. So as the threats and concerns escalate, so does the precaution. But also, before we get to that, it's not just from within. As you have these escalating concerns from inside, in verse 11, Sanballat and Tobiah's threats also escalate. Now they're planning to attack at some time they don't expect and kill them and stop the work. So I think the way Nehemiah reacts to all these various threats and concerns is very admirable. He doesn't say, well, we've prayed, we trust in God, we're just going to leave things as they are. You know, this is not a good trait about me. When I'm trying to get something done and somebody voices concerns that I feel like are from a cowardly heart, it pushes me to act foolishly because I want to prove them wrong. It's actually not that dangerous. You're a coward. That's not how Nehemiah reacts. It's interesting. Nehemiah reacts in two ways to these dangers. First, as if he's almost, maybe he is, as if he's considering the concerns of his brethren, he creates even more precautions. He doesn't just leave a guard. It's possible that they even stop the work for a moment and they station people all around so that they are even more defended, which is the opposite of how I would react. I would just leave things as they are and be arrogant. But no, he doesn't act foolishly. But also, for those who are afraid, he encourages them. In 14, he exhorts them. He doesn't treat them like the enemies. In fact, he kind of encourages them, join us, work with us, have courage. I think this is what Jude is talking about by admonishing the weak. He admonishes the weak. So I think verses 7 through 14 answer the question, is it appropriate for Christians to take precautions in times of danger? Yeah. You see Nehemiah taking plenty of precautions here. But here's a question. What do you think he's trying to protect? If his goal is self-preservation and trying to protect himself, he would have just had him flee. In verse 11, the goal of the enemies is, yes, to kill them, but I think their primary goal is to stop the work. Nehemiah and his companions, they're not an army. Yeah, Nehemiah had a contingent of soldiers, don't get me wrong, but there was not a lot of people living in Jerusalem, and the walls are only halfway up. They don't have very good defensive structures. Also, he says clearly in verse 13, there's open spaces in the wall. Like, if they're trying to bunker up in this city, this is a very bad tactical decision. And not only are there not very many people there to fight, many of the people who were there were old men and women. That's not the best quality soldier. So, nothing against women, but that's not the way they're built. So, if his purpose was to protect himself, he's making all the wrong decisions. His purpose here, I think, is to protect the work. See, I don't think the question is, should we or shouldn't we take precautions? Should we or shouldn't we protect? The question is, what are we trying to protect? See, you know what the fool and the coward both have in common? Neither get very much work done. The fool sabotages themselves in the work before they accomplish anything, and anything they accomplish gets destroyed. The coward runs and hides as soon as things get scary. So, as different as they are, the brash fool and the coward, as far as work goes, share a lot. The question is, what is our purpose? What is our priority? Is our priority to do God's work or to preserve our life? Now, once again, those two can kind of coexist, but not as equals. Jesus says in Matthew chapter 6, verse 24, you can only serve two masters. He's talking about money there, but it applies to our service to God in our lives. You can't prioritize your life and serving God equally. One must take priority over the other. Sure, it's good to practice some self-preservation, but not at the cost of our faith. I think a really good, another practical example of this is in Acts chapter 8. In Acts chapter 8, during a time of intense persecution, I really love the example of the brethren who are scattered because of the persecution of Paul. In Acts chapter 8, verse 3, it says, but Saul was ravaging the church and entering house after house. He dragged off men and women and committed them to prison. Now those who were scattered went about preaching the word. Now, are they practicing some self-preservation by fleeing Jerusalem? I think so. I think that was a smart thing to do. But in all practicality, how practical is it to flee religious persecution and while you're fleeing said religious persecution to proclaim said religion? You're putting a target on your back. It's kind of hard to hide when you're doing that. So sure, they practice self-preservation, but they didn't stop serving God. I think we see Nehemiah doing that. In fact, their protection, if anything, in Nehemiah chapter 4, is they're putting their own lives on the line. It's not the walls that are going to fall first if Jerusalem gets attacked. It'll be the people. They're going to be the ones to die. So yes, there is a time and place for precaution, but not at the cost of the work. Read verses 15 through 23 with me of Nehemiah chapter 4. When our enemies heard that it was known to us and that God had frustrated their plan, we all returned to the wall, each to his work. From that day on, half my servants worked on construction and half held the spears, shields, bows, coats of mail, and the leaders stood behind the whole house of Judah who were building the wall. Those who carried burdens were loaded in such a way that each labored on the work with one hand and held his weapon with another. And each of the builders had his sword strapped at his side while he built. The man who sounded the trumpet was beside me. I said to the nobles and to the officials and to the rest of the people, the work is great and widely spread, and we are separated on the wall, far from one another. And a place where you hear the sound of the trumpet, rally to us. Our God would fight for us. So we labored at the work, and half of them held the spears from the break of dawn until the stars came out. And I also said to the people at that time, let every man and his servant pass the night within Jerusalem, that they may be a guard for us by night and may labor by day. So neither I nor my brothers nor my servants nor the men of the guard who followed me, none of us took off our clothes, and each one kept his weapon in his right hand. So Nehemiah doesn't know what we know. Nehemiah knows that the plan of his enemies are frustrated. And so do they just let their guard down and say, okay, we can go back to normal and pretend like nothing's wrong. No. He stays vigilant. Thankfully, it's not needed, or better, his vigilance prevented his vigilance from being needed. But after things start to subside, they don't just take it easy and pretend like it's going to be going great. And there's just so much good here. You see courage, you see preparedness, you see steadfastness. I mean, they're not only continuing working. I love the description, you have your tool in one hand and your weapon in the other. They are ready, but notice they're lacking neither. They don't stop working. They don't say, okay, we're going to hunker down until this all subsides. There seems to be a brief hunkering down moment, but once they figure out what's going on, they get right back to work. And, you know, after spending just a week or two in Israel in the hot Judean sun, I cannot imagine how miserable it would have been working masonry, which is hard work in of itself, carrying a full suit of armor, all your tools, and your weapons. And not only that, at least I had the privilege of going to a hotel and getting a shower. They couldn't do either. They couldn't even change their clothes. That is incredible. So, you know what that takes? That takes self-denial. See, oftentimes, we sacrifice the work because we're not willing to deny ourselves. If there was anybody here who had a spoiled heart and they weren't steadfast, they would have left a long time ago. The people who stayed and proceeded to do this work were those who denied themselves. That's true for us too. Jesus says, if we want to be a disciple, in Matthew chapter 16, verse 24, we must deny ourselves, take up our cross, and follow him. So the same type of self-denial they needed to overcome the physical adversity, we need to overcome spiritual adversity and physical adversity too. But something else we see that's necessary is they had good leadership. A really practical takeaway we can take from this is that the leadership in our congregation needs to be good, obviously. They need to be communicative. They need to have plans. They need to be reactive to what's going on. If Nehemiah just said, do whatever you want, it would have been chaos. But he had a plan. He acted on those plans. He had contingency plans, literally. And he took initiative. And you know what the people did? They followed said plans. So just as our leaders need to lead us well, we also need to be good followers. It's just as necessary to have people who listen. If Nehemiah's men didn't listen, once again, it would have turned out as chaos too. Both are necessary. So we should have plans and ideas about what to do during times of difficulty. Something else that is a very practical application is notice how they're taking turns. You have people holding half of the spears at one time and people holding half the spears at others, people working at night, working at day. There's delegation. This is important during difficult times or not. But being willing to share in the work, communicate who can do what and what needs to be done is so important. Nehemiah didn't just do all this by himself. There was delegation, there was communication, there was sharing. I guess you can put it like Galatians chapter 6, verse 2, where we need to bear one another's burdens. And that's not just a practical thing, that's a heart thing. As Nehemiah said in verse 14, they weren't doing this just for themselves. They were carrying the burdens of all who were in Judea. They were doing this for their brothers, their sons, their daughters, and their wives. They were doing this for all the cowards who were afraid to join them in the work and were encouraging them not to. They were bearing the burdens in this work for those who were not yet born. If we are going to persevere during persecution, it's important that we do it for our own souls. But something else to keep in mind is how we persevere will have an impact on others. If very few people stand fast through persecution, there's going to be a big shortage of preachers. Because guess what? Everybody here is a preacher, in a sense. We all have the responsibility to evangelize the gospel. You just can't expect the preachers and elders to do that. But if we all fall away, it's going to be really hard for the kingdom to spread. So we need to have a heart and bodies that bear the burdens for other people. And sometimes bearing the burden means carrying a lot of armor, doing a lot of heavy work. Sometimes carrying the burden means you're willing to be holed up with these people and be patient with them for several days. I mean, working in a factory for 10 years before I started preaching, there were a lot of times where myself and others got close to fighting each other on the hot days. That cabinet shop in the middle of the summer was like an oven. And when you're sweaty, hot, and tired, you're ready to fight real quick. Men who've worked in industry know what I'm talking about. These guys had to persevere through that for a long time, and they maintain unity. That's impressive. Something else, in Deuteronomy 6, verse 5, God says, "You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, and all your might." And they wouldn't have been able to do any of that if that wasn't true. To suffer, to face danger, to be patient, to be unified. Yeah, maybe worldly people can do some of that, but in order to do all of it as such a sacrificial way, you need to love something much greater than just yourself. And I'm sure there were people there because King Artaxerxes said, do this with Nehemiah. But for Nehemiah and the Jews that were there, this has to be their reason. A genuine, sincere love for God. And we literally see them loving with all their heart, all their soul, and all their might, literally, in this chapter. You know, something that we have that they didn't, something that should embolden us to be even more brave, is the hope of eternal life. I don't know what Nehemiah understood about the afterlife, but I do know that we have more than what he did. We have the hope of eternal life. Keep in mind, they didn't know what we knew, and yet they were still able to be so brave. How much more should that be for us? If you are a Christian, have you been living by courage and by faith? Have you been working hard? If you're not a Christian, well, it's good if you want to be like Nehemiah, but what's more important for you at the time is you need to be with Jesus. You need to consider how to be right with Jesus. In Romans chapter 6, verses 20 through 23, Paul writes that if we join in Christ in his death, we will be joined with him in his newness of life. And that happens in baptism. Romans chapter 6, Paul also writes that we need to give our bodies as slaves to righteousness. We need to repent. Romans chapter 6, verse 10, or chapter 10, verse 13, Paul says we need to confess Jesus as Lord. Paul also writes, Romans chapter 3, verses 23 through 25, that we are saved by grace through faith. If you need the help of the congregation this morning, please come forward while we sing the song of invitation.